See you all here today. We're going to get right into Hosea chapter 9. Hosea chapter 9 and pick up our series where we left off. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, raise your hand and we would love to get you one so we're all on the same page. Hosea is complicated enough that if you're reading a different page, you're going to be lost and behind. No? Everybody? Everybody's good? All right, Hosea chapter 9. Hosea chapter 9, we're going to continue on in Hosea's message, and this is an important lesson. It's going to continue to remind us about the themes that he's been talking about these last many weeks. I'm sorry, I was trying to turn, and while I was talking, I couldn't remember what part of the Bible was in. These themes that he's been talking about, but he's going to hit it from a little bit of a different angle here. What he tends to do in the book of Hosea, even though there is a operative illustration throughout this whole book, he also continues to use continual illustrations that we would understand, and that's what we need, because we're not that smart. And so sometimes when he gives us spiritual ideas, it's difficult for us to wrap our mind around. That's why Jesus always spoke in parables, because it's easy for us to wrap our mind around. And so Hosea tends to use a lot of these consistent themes, but then he brings it up in different ways so that we understand the significance and the importance and the truth value of what he's trying to communicate. This book is, at the end of the day, about relationship. This is not just about the rights and the wrongs that we do. It's about how those things factor into our relationship with God. And that's why the book of Hosea starts with the illustration of Hosea marrying an unfaithful wife who's continuing to live unfaithfully, and yet Hosea wants her back anyway. And in the beginning, it goes back and forth to remind us and tell us that Hosea is like God and his wife is like Israel. Just as his wife was unfaithful to Hosea, and God was still faithful to him, and Hosea was still faithful to her, Israel had been unfaithful to God, and God was still faithful to Israel, because he loved them, not because they deserved it. Now, why, in what way were they unfaithful? He outlines a lot of work, their need for against them. And then as he moves forward, he says that they were trying to outwork their need for God, as we saw last week, with politics, religion, money, security, but it wasn't going well. We often do that. Our life isn't going how we want it to, and so we try to outwork our need for God by trying to invest all that time, energy, and money into stuff that we think can override our need for him. And that's where they were. But here we are, in this next section, and employs a different kind of illustration over and over again in the end of chapter 9 and throughout chapter 10, and that is plants and fruit. This is an easy one for us because we live in Pennsylvania and not California. We live in farm country, so these pictures are easier for us to understand. When I was in high school, I liked horticulture a lot. I liked to plant. I liked to see things grow and to produce, whether it was a flowering plant or whether it was something that actually brought forth fruit. It was nice to watch it grow. It was enjoyable to put work into the field and then watch as something came out of it. For farmers, it's not just a fun activity or a hobby or therefore aesthetic value. I mean, fields of barley are super fun to look at, but that's not why they planted the barley, because it was nice to look at because they needed a background for their photo shoot. That was not why they planted the barley. They planted it for the well-being on their family, and they rely on the truth that what you sow, you will reap. And so they want this to be true. We must reckon with the simple and undeniable truth that what we put into our life and into others will bring about an inevitable result. We only want that to be true when the result is something that we planned for, expect, or want. But when it's not something we want or planned for or expected, we want our actions to not bring about an inevitable result. And this past week, I was reading through the testimony of one of our church members, and they were talking about all the things that they could throughout their life, and they had gone through a lot of things, and a lot of them was their own doing. And they could see two things that I noticed all throughout their testimony. One was that they could see God working in all the areas of their life. Hey, at this time, I didn't realize what was happening, but God was doing this, bringing me to this place. But the other thing that they kept on bringing up was they could trace the result of the decisions that they made. I did this, and therefore this happened. No wonder. I did this, and therefore this came out of it. They sowed, therefore they reaped. And so the question is to us, what are you sowing? What are you sowing? Point number one, Because you are always sowing something. You are always sowing something. Now, obviously, I guess I should define it just in case. Sowing is the action of putting the seeds in the ground. It is the spreading of some kind of plant that will grow one way or the other. You are always sowing something. Now, I'm going to walk through these major sections, the end of chapter 9, the beginning of chapter 10, the end of chapter 10, as our main points. However, I want to jump ahead a little bit for this first point. Look at verse number 11 of chapter 10, Hosea chapter 10, verse number 11. We're going to reread this later, but I want you to see this simple picture. Ephraim, which is Israel, is a heifer that is taught, heifer, the cow, and loveth to tread out the corn. I passed over upon her fair neck. I will make Ephraim to ride. Judah shall plow. Break up your fallow ground for clods. Sow to yourselves in righteousness, reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground, for it's time to seek the Lord, till he come and rain righteousness upon you. But ye have plowed wickedness, and ye've reaped iniquity. Ye have eaten the fruit of lies. Now there's a lot that we skipped over, and there's a lot that I'm skipping over here as well for the sake of time at the moment. But he's finishing this section with an encouragement about how that we can reap and sow the right way, even though we have been reaping and sowing the wrong way. But there's a simple picture he draws here. He says, Ephraim, you are that ox that treads corn. You have a good, strong neck, and you have a yoke around it. Israel, you are riding. Judah, you are plowing. Jacob, you are breaking up the ground. He doesn't say you should. He says you are. You are in the field. You are plowing your field. You are sowing something. You are. Every one of you in here, we are sowing. We don't get to choose whether or not we go out into the field of our life and sow seeds. You are sowing. You have a yoke around your neck. You are breaking up ground. You are planting seeds. You are sowing something. As the general consensus, I don't even know how they would calculate it, but that's what the internet said and many articles did, so whatever. We'll use it for the sake of argument. Have all agreed upon the fact that roughly a human being makes about 35,000 decisions a day. Will I do this? Will I do that? Will I eat this? Will I eat this? Will I eat this now? Should I eat a snack now? No, I won't eat a snack. Should I eat a snack now? No, I won't eat a snack. I'm going to go down to the bathroom. Or should I stay here? Should I wait till I finish my project? We make 35,000 decisions a day. Let's say that that's twice as much. Let's say that that is way over the top. Let's say it's only 10,000 decisions a day. That's a lot of sowing. We are doing something all the time. And when you sow, you reap. You had that yoke on your neck all the time. You are riding. You are plowing the field. You are furrowing rows all the time. Always you are sowing. Number two, you reap according to what you sow. You reap according to what you sow. You are sowing. You will reap. And by the way, we want this. When I spoke about the problem of evil a few months ago, I said this about life. We want the world to be such that when we do something to it, something happens. Then we're like, oh, why is there so many problems in the world? Well, that's because a lot of people do stupid stuff. So stupid stuff comes out of it. And what we're asking God to do is only make the result come out of the things that are good, not the result come out of the things that we do. So we don't actually want a world where there is sowing and reaping. But the thing is, a lot of times in our life, we want there to be an outcome. You don't work out because you don't want to be physically fit or more healthy. You work out because you do want there to be a beneficial result of it. You don't plant because you don't want to harvest. You don't go to school and study because you don't want to learn. You don't build relationships because you don't want to know people more. You don't play a video game because you don't want to make it to the next level. You want to have a result to what you do. And that's what we want there to be the case. But the result attends what we do, and sometimes it's not a good result because the things we're doing are not good. So let's go back to chapter 9, and we're going to look at some of these things that we're sowing and some of the things that they reap because of it. Letter A. They're a little longer, but there are several parts to it, so I tried to shove it into each point. Letter A, refusing to spiritually use your God-given opportunities robs your family of its future. Refusing to spiritually use your God-given opportunities robbed your family of its future. In the first section, he uses a metaphor here in chapter 9 of a vine and a fig tree to talk about their situations and how what they would produce. Just as a vine and a fig tree produces fruit, there's a result, there's produce from it. Likewise, people, they produce actions, they produce results, but they also produce children. And there is an effect that they pass on as well with what they produce. Now, this is a very common illustration to this book, especially because he's talking in terms of relationships. So he uses this father, mother, children picture all the time. Sometimes the children are a picture of their bad decisions, like just as parents produce children and then they train them to be a certain way, people produce actions that happen in their life. He also flips the illustration back and forth and says, sometimes when you do the bad things, then it affects your literal children later on. And so I want us to read this verse, verse number 10. He starts with the opportunities they had. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness, and I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first, as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first time. So both of these are symbols of like refreshment. You don't find grapes in the wilderness. Grapes are found in the vineyard. Grapes are found in places that are intending to be found. Have you been walking through the woods and you find a mulberry tree? Right? And it's like, oh, it's a mulberry tree. And then you pick a handful and you eat them because you know what it is and you're not going to die. And it's nice that there it is. And so it's a pleasant surprise almost. So the whole idea, grapes in the wilderness, is it's a pleasant surprise. The fig tree at the first time is like the first harvest of figs in the season. Now, they didn't ship it down from whatever tropical climates during the winter so they could still buy it at Giant. So in their culture, if you had the first times of your fruit season, was the first time you got to eat that fruit for months, half a year maybe. When you get to the end of the season, it's like, now. A couple weeks ago, we were all super excited about tomatoes, right? And now I was like, tomatoes. I have my first tomato sandwich of the year. But the first one is like, oh, I get to have my first tomato sandwich of the year. Super excited. Now, I don't know about you, that's me. Or whatever it might be. It's the first peaches of the year. And, oh, you're super excited. In a few weeks, it'll be like, peaches. And later in the fall, apples. But the first one is a big deal, especially then when they would not have had one for many months. And so both of these, he says, oh, this is how I viewed you, something pleasant to love. I mean, later he says this in verse number 13. I'm going to come back to verse 10, but look at verse 13. Ephraim, as I saw Tyrus, is planted in a pleasant place. They had good opportunities. God put them in position to be successful. But peppered throughout this passage is their wickedness in spite of their good opportunities that they had. Look at verse 10. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first time. But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves unto their shame. And their abominations were according as they loved. They loved vile things. Their love was vile then. Baal Peor. This is a story that gets brought up several times, not a ton, but several times throughout the Bible. It's a very pivotal moment. It's right after the story of Balaam in the book of Numbers. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I'll tell you so you know what's going on. In the book of Numbers, Balaam tries to curse the people of Israel from the mountaintop. God says, no, you can't curse them. You can only bless them. Other people don't get to decide a curse or a blessing on your life. And so we fear the world too much, by the way. The world hates us, therefore they will curse us. Now, God's only going to let them curse them if he lets them. But he loves his people. He will only let you bless them. But you know, we can curse and bless ourselves to the extent that we can put ourselves in a position to be cursed, and that's exactly what happens to them. God said, don't curse the people, don't curse the people, don't curse the people. You're not allowed to curse the people. You can only bless them. Very next story over, they start sleeping with the Midianites nearby, and there's a plague. They did it to themselves. But they were blatant about it. A leader's son takes his new girlfriend, who, by sleeping with them, was not only immoral because they were kind of dating immoral people, but also because that involved them being a part of their idolatrous practices as well. So it compounded the wickedness. And they blatantly walk in front of the tabernacle to go sleep with each other over in their tent. And Phinehas, Aaron's grandson, takes a spear and stabs them through. That's how that story ends. And the plague stops. And he refers back, and so it happened in Peor when they worshiped Baal. Baal, Peor. And this story shows up as a recognition of two things. One is blatant rebellion against God, and it also gets used as an illustration of radically dealing with sin in order for our lives not to continue to fall apart. And here he brings them up. You were in the position to be blessed. God wanted to bless you. Story, chapter after chapter with Balaam. No, you can't curse them. You can only bless them. And then you put it on yourselves like you did at Baal Peor. Later, verse number 15, just for the sake of looking down at it, verse 15, he talks about Gilgal. All their wickedness is in Gilgal. Now look at this. For there I hated them. For the wickedness of their doings, I will drive them out of my house and will love them no more. All their princes are revolters. Gilgal had great potential. This was a place of memorial from Joshua. This is a place of the anointing of Saul, the first king. But just like Saul, great opportunities used terribly. Now, according to this book, earlier in chapter 4, later in chapter 12, Gilgal gets to be brought up as a place of sin. Apparently, it was a center of idolatry. This is what you're doing. And he uses the words hate and love here. He's referring to his relationship with them. Rather than having the sweet relationship of loyalty and commitment, they were making God their enemy. And rather than enjoying a covenant relationship with God, they were placing themselves outside of the caring love of God. Remember all the way back in chapter 1? Their sinful life brought children, and they called her Leruchama, not loved. And here he says, you are not enjoying the love of God, not love. Great opportunities used poorly. So throughout this passage, he talks about their vine. You are a good vine, a good fig tree. Will it be fruitful? Well, I'll tell you this, you will reap what you sow. So look at the passage again, verse 11. As for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. From the birth and from the womb and from the conception, though they bring up their children, yet will I bereave them that there shall not be a man left. Yea, woe also to them when I depart from them. Ephraim, as I saw Tyrus, is planted in a pleasant place. But Ephraim shall bring forth his children to the murderer. Give them, O Lord. What wilt thou give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. Ephraim is smitten. This is where he talks about Gilgal later on in chapter 15. Verse number 16. Ephraim is smitten. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Yea, though they bring forth, yet will I slay even the beloved fruit of their womb. My God will cast them away because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. So he goes back and forth in his metaphor in this passage. He starts out, they're like a tree. They're like a vine. They bring forth fruit. But now he's going back and forth with them. What are you doing? You are actually people, and you actually bring forth families. What are you doing? Tree, what are you doing to your fruit? Mom and dad, what are you doing to your families? And he says, just as you reap what you sow, you bring out the fruit that you're producing. He says, you will bring wickedness and destruction on to your children. He says that their glory will depart quickly. Things can go downhill really fast in life. Oh, we're fine. We don't need God. It can turn around tomorrow like a bird that flies away. Ever do that? You go look out on your deck. There's a bird. Everyone look at the bird. And you open the door to go look at the bird. Psh, gone. Gone. You, like, sometimes, this happened before. Like, I will turn in the house. Hey, Sam, look at it. Nope, just kidding. Never mind. That's how quickly, gone. That's how he compares how quickly their glory could leave. Psh, gone. Glory will fly away. He says, we're just going to raise our families without God. And then he says this, but then what if your children don't even live? You know, you need God for life. Well, we can live without God. No, you can't live without God. From God comes all life. He says, then their babies die. But what if they don't die? He says, then some of them will later. Many of these children are going to go into captivity. They're going to bring war onto their nation, and their own families would suffer. There's a really interesting double meaning in verse 13. I want you to look at it. Ephraim shall bring forth his children to the murderer. A lot of people believe that there's a double meaning here. See, the children of Israel had been worshiping Baal voluntarily. They had been worshiping the world. And part of Baal worship, and part of the worship of some of these other gods like Molech, was child sacrifice. They were giving their children to the murderers. But then the double meaning here is that because of their sin and their wickedness and their idolatry, they're introducing into their nation, Assyria and these other violent nations would show up. And therefore, they were giving their children to those murderers. And see, the double meaning here is very interesting because what it's showing us is they had chosen to give their kids to the world, and so now the world was going to come and take their kids. See, when we don't spiritually prioritize the blessings that God's giving to us, we think we're protecting our families. We're really just giving them away. That's why, by the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip and make sure it's in the offering plate, we'd appreciate that. Now, here's the thing. All of you in here are in a good position to be spiritually successful. You're in Sunday school. There's a lot of people in Dover that are not. You're in a place where you can hear God's word. You have a church family. You know what the right thing is to do. You can be, like Colossians tells us to be, rooted and built up in him and established, like a good tree producing good fruit. But many of us are going to introduce our families and our children to the things of this world. We'll take the spiritual opportunities that we have and we'll use that increase in order to increase our knowledge of worldly things. Their thinking, their activities, their values, their philosophies, their restrictions, their morality, their priorities. And we are sacrificing them to simply be destroyed. As you sacrifice your children to the idolatry and the immorality of the world, you are sacrificing them to be destroyed. Why? Because you reap what you sow. See, I look at this, and I don't know about you, maybe I'm the only unspiritual person in the room. I look at this and I think, man, God was being mean at his result. And this is our tendency. We gloss over all the decisions that they made, and then we get mad at the consequence. Why would God allow their families to be destroyed? They destroyed their families. And God's saying, don't do that. This will be the result. And we're like, wow, God, how mean are you? And that's how people react in life, isn't it? They make all their decisions selfishly. They make all their decisions unspiritually. They don't prioritize the Lord. They don't prioritize their walk with him. They don't prioritize their church family. And then one day, all things start to fall apart, and they say, why didn't God intervene? Well, God was trying to intervene all along. We just chose not to be part of the program, and you reap what you sow. That's the first one. Oh, my. Okay, maybe point number two is going to be enough. Letter B. I was looking over my notes, and I thought, that might be it. Okay, letter B. Very similar to this, but we'll see how he explains it here. Misusing flourishing blessings to flourish in selfishness brings flourishing problems. When you misuse your flourishing blessings so that you flourish in selfishness, then you will bring flourishing problems. In the same vein as the blessings and help that God gives and provides from the last sections, he talks about all the things that they produce, and he gives a very vivid picture. Look at verse number 1 of chapter 10. Verse number 1 of chapter 10. Israel is an empty vine. He bringeth forth fruit unto himself. According to the multitude of his fruit, he hath increased the altars. According to the goodness of his land, they have made goodly images. Before we get too far into that, I want to talk about the empty vine. The word empty there doesn't actually have the idea of withering and lifeless. It's not the picture. The word empty there has the idea of luscious, believe it or not, but in a destructive way, like an invasive plant, which usually isn't very fruit-bearing either. We know about invasive plants around here. And this is the picture. They were flourishing in there. They were growing fast. They were planted in a pleasant place, we saw last section. But just because it's going fast doesn't mean it's going well, right? On the way down to the Sword Conference, I haven't gone to the Sword Conference in a few years, but one thing I always remember driving down, I forget what road it is. I wasn't driving, so I didn't care. But with driving down the highway all the way down to North Carolina, you pass by mile after mile after mile after hundreds of miles of the kutza vine? You know what I'm talking about? Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Nobody? A couple of you? Okay. So somebody brought it over from Japan one time, and apparently nothing hinders it, and it just grows, and it grows, and it grows. And it has devoured whole forests and there are entire forests filled with dead trees that are covered in a very much alive vine. And so it looks like trees, but they're not trees. They're just dead wood covered in an invasive plant. It is flourishing, but it's not going well, right? It's going, but to destruction. This is kind of the picture he has here. He says in this passage, they brought fruit. They had a multitude of fruit. They had increase. They had the goodness of the land. But every time he brought up the good thing, he brings up the attending bad thing they did with it. He says, you brought up fruit unto yourself, selfishly. I'm going to bring fruit, and I'm going to consume it. He used the increase to increase the number of altars he built. You see how he does that? He used the goodness of the land to make images that were goodly. So he turns it on itself. We had good things, and so we used it poorly. It's very similar. Did I give you Isaiah chapter 5? Did I give that to you? Okay. This is very similar to an illustration that Isaiah uses. By the way, Isaiah is preaching at the same time that Hosea is. So they would have been, you know, acquaintances. But they were definitely contemporaries. But look at verse number 1. Look at this is a really fascinating way that Isaiah says this. I will sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. And he's talking about the people of Israel. And by the way, he purposely calls them well-beloved plenty of times here. Like, I care about you, and I put you in a good field. He fenced it, verse 2, and gathered out the stones thereof and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in the midst of it. He did everything he needed to do therein. He looked that it should bring forth grapes. Like, he did everything he needed to do. He built it, he planted it, he set up the whole field to go well, to bring forth grapes. And it brought forth, verse 2, wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. I love this. He just puts them on the spot. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I've not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. He says, what do you expect me to do? Was it the person's fault that planted the vineyard? He says, I planted you well, and there's nothing else for me to have done. And yet it brought forth wild grapes anyway. Verse 5, and now go to, I will tell you what I'll do to my vineyard. I'll take away the hedge thereof, it shall be eaten up. Break down the wall thereof, it shall be trodden down. I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned or digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant place. He looked for judgment, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry. We must be very careful not to misinterpret God's heart. Just because you start out with a lot of things, you might have a great vineyard that's producing a lot of wild grapes, and it doesn't mean he's happy with the vineyard. You might be taking the blessings of God on your life and your family and using it for yourself. So ask yourself that question. What do you prioritize your money for? What do you prioritize your time for? What do you prioritize your resources for? A lot of people take God's blessings that God has put in their life and planted them and built them and put the tower and made the wine press. And like you were set up to be spiritually successful. And we use it all for ourselves. We bring fruit to ourselves. And when we flourish in blessings so that our flesh flourishes, we only flourish in problems. So let's read the passage. Verse number 2. Their heart is divided. That means they have a false heart. A lot of people look the part, but they're not actually the part. Now shall they be found faulty. He shall break down their altars. He shall spoil their images. The fleshly things, this is interesting, that they built with their increase will just end up being destroyed. They had enough money to build altars, and now those altars are going to fall apart anyway. All the things that they made, it's all just going to fall. It's all going to be destroyed. For now they shall say, we have no king because we feared not the Lord. What then should a king do to us? We'll return to that later, probably next week, I guess. They've spoken words, swearing falsely and making a covenant. That means they try to paste on religion to cover up their selfishness. Thus, judgment springeth up. Watch, they're flourishing. Judgment springeth up as hemlock in the furrows of the field. They're still flourishing, and they are growing a whole bunch of weeds really quickly. Hemlock is poison. They're plowing their fields, and next season, a bunch of poison grew up. In Pennsylvania, things grow. This is not the desert. The desert, nothing grows. In Pennsylvania, everything grows. And a lot of things grow that you don't want. Some of the things that grow are poison, ivy, poison oak, poison sumac. It was funny, when I make Persian food at my house, and one of the things you sprinkle all over the top, this is completely unrelated, one of the things you sprinkle all over the top is sumac. We go to the store, we buy sumac, and we eat it. So I think it's a different plant, but either way, we don't end up with poison inside of our stomachs, so we're okay, but that's been a thing. But things grow. Now listen, church, we're so concerned about having enough. We never want to live in the proverbial desert, right, of God's blessings. We don't want to not have enough. We want to make sure that God's blessing us. We want to make sure that we're flourishing. We have enough things. And many of us are not actually that concerned or apprehensive about living in a fast-growing state of God's blessings and allowing the wrong things to grow. We're perfectly happy living selfishly as long as we have plenty. That's our measure of whether or not God's happy with us, that we have things going on. I have time, I have money, I have energy, I have stuff. I must be fine. God must be blessing. Well, he might have started you out blessing, but ask yourself the simple question. Would you rather live in the desert where nothing grows, or would you rather live in a house covered in beautiful, lush poison ivy? Some of you are actually sitting here thinking, I don't know the answer to that question, actually, to be honest. Many of us are, spiritually, we don't want to live in the desert. We want to make sure that we have plenty. We want to make sure that God's giving us stuff. We want to have money in the bank. We want to have a TV on the wall. We want to have land in the back. We want to be happy. We want to have stuff. But if our life is spiritually covered in hemlock, that's fine with us, as long as it's moving. And he says, I gave you plenty of opportunities to flourish, and you are. And hemlock is growing in your fields. Right now, my lawn is the worst. My lawn is terrible. I'm working on this spot right now in the back. Only weeds. We all joke about it here, like, hey, at least it's green, you know. And that's what a lot of us do. Well, you know, at least things are going. None of it's grass, but at least it's green. And that's how a lot of us view our life. God blesses you. You don't live in the desert of God's blessings. You have stuff. You have money in the bank. You live in the garden. And you are growing the wrong things with it. Weeds and poison in your life. You fight all the time at home about the money that you have. You spend time filling your life with activity because you can afford it. But now it's choking your life out. You have more than you need, and you don't know where to put it all. You don't spend time with your family or with God's people because you have so much filling your life. You're flourishing, but the wrong things. You look at your life and say, well, we aren't struggling, so we must be fine. Ever said that? I've actually said that before. Well, we're not struggling, so we must be fine. If I'm not struggling, then everything should be okay. Not necessarily. You might not be living in the desert, but your house might be covered in poison. And is that what you really wanted? That's actually a good time to stop, I think. What time is it? It's not a good time to stop. Look at verse number 5. I still have time. I'll finish up this point then. Verse number 5, there's a second half to this. It hits on the heels of that. He goes from the picture of the ivy and the fig and the tree and the vine, and he moves on to them specifically building idols. He talks about their idolatry that they've been investing in. Verse 5, the inhabitants of Samaria shall fear because of the calves of Beth-Aven. The golden idol calf that they made, remember, was in Bethel. Remember, a couple weeks ago I said that this is a play on words. Bethel means the house of God. Beth-Aven means the house of iniquity. Their downfall, turning its name on its head. Their idols of gold would be their downfall. Look at verse 5. For the people thereof shall mourn over it, and the priests thereof that rejoiced on it, for the glory thereof, because it is departed from it. It shall be also carried unto Assyria for a present to King Jareb. Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his own counsel. Everything they invested into. Like I said last week sometime, you didn't just have gold. You didn't just pull gold out of your closet and build an idol. That's money. It's a lot of money to build an idol. They invested in their idols. And what happened to it? Got carried away. Went to Assyria. All that they invest into their idolatry and their worldliness are all going to the world anyway. Verse 7. As for Samaria, their capital, her king is cut off as the foam upon the water, just as volatile as the sea foam is, and just is as stable as their king was. And once again, we'll bring up the kings next week. The high places also of Aven, iniquity, the house of Aven, house of iniquity, the worship places where they sinned, the sin of Israel, it'll be destroyed. The thorn and thistle shall come up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. This is just similar to last week. All that they built, what grows? Weeds. Weeds grow. Remember I said, and I made a big point about this last week. It said, thorns and nettles. It's the same terminology as Proverbs 24. Proverbs 24 says, don't be lazy, otherwise your wall will get covered over with weeds. Right? Thorns and nettles cover the face thereof of the lazy man, the slothful man. But then in Hosea, he says, you worked really hard with all your stuff, your religion and your idols and your politics and your money. You thought you put a lot of time and effort into that. And what happened to your stuff? It's still covered in thorns and nettles anyway, as if you didn't do anything at all. And here he has the same thing. What's happening to your field? Covered in thorns and thistles. That's what's growing. And he says, they'll say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. They end up living in fear, almost fatalistic fear. There's a sense of suicide in this statement. They're just done. They don't know what to do. They feel very hopeless, and they just want to be finished. This is almost the exact same language that's used in Revelation chapter 6. There's terrible judgment coming in Revelation chapter 6. God's judging the world for its sin. And it gets to the heels of all of these judgments that he pours out onto the earth by breaking the seals of the book that's in the right hand of the Father that's given to the Lamb. And as he does, the world is not expecting it. And rather than turn and repent and go back to God, their response is to just hide and escape from it all. I gave you the passage in Revelation 6. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the chief captains, the mighty men, every bondman, every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne. The great day of his wrath has come. Who shall be able to stand? What are we going to do? We don't know. So we just want to be done. And isn't that a reaction? God blesses us. We use his blessings for our own selfish desires, and then things don't make us happy, or we lose those blessings. And so our reaction is to run away from God as a result, as if he is to be feared and run away from, rather than acknowledge that we need to run toward him and experience his goodness. We must simply learn to expect that if we use God's flourishing blessings to flourish our selfishness, we will flourish in problems. So if we reverse that cycle, maybe the outcome will be different. But when we say, oh man, God, he gave me a life, and now it's all covered in weeds. It's like, yeah, well, you planted them. And God looks at you. What more was I supposed to do? I gave you the vineyard. I gave you your church family. I gave you my word. I gave you a relationship. What else was I supposed to do? And we go, oh, I don't know. Don't talk to me. And we run away from God instead. And so we'll stop there for now because we ran out of time. I kind of expected that, but we reap what we sow. We're going to see two more reapings and sowings next week, and I don't have a whole lot in it, so we'll see if we can try to continue on to chapter 11 or not, but maybe not. We might just keep it short, but we'll do these last two. The last two really are just the one last section, and I want us to examine in our life, and this week, this is my challenge to you. Recognize the number of decisions that you're making. Just do that. Just be cognizantly aware of the fact that you're making a ton, thousands apparently, according to leading psychologists of the day, thousands of decisions a day. You are always sowing. What will come of the decisions that you make? Are you sowing the things that you ought to be? Or are you sowing poison in your field? One day it will grow. It will. And then you'll wake up with a house covered in poison ivy and not know what to do. So run to the Lord. So we're gonna pick that up next week. Let's pray. Father, thank you for...